Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I hear Davos, Switzerland is absolutely lovely this time of year. It's just too bad the president and his treasury secretary can't make it. Mr. Obama's got a speech to give tonight, and Timothy Geithner spent his day on Capitol Hill. We'll tell you about that, and we will take you to Davos, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 27th of January. Glad you could be with us. You know, every now and then, official Washington stops being so official when people actually say what's on their mind. Those moments are obviously few and far between, but there was one today on Capitol Hill. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was testifying about AIG. Why, in the heat of the moment, the government didn't want to say which banks the big insurance company was helping to bail out. Geithner was getting some not entirely friendly questioning about that from Republican Congressman Daryl Issa.
Well, Congressman, as you know, this question of disclosure was the subject of huge amount of controversy. And most people...
You think?
Yeah. That's what my son says, and I agree with you.
A lot of people do think, which is why Mr. Geithner and his predecessor, former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, were in the witness chair today. They were explaining what happened with AIG back in September of 08. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Remember how tense things were when AIG was bailed out? Hugh Johnson of Johnson Illington Advisors does. He says on those scary days, everyone was asking if AIG were allowed to fail.
Will that hurt the confidence in the entire system? In other words, cause a contemporary run on all major financial institutions and really bring the financial system to a screeching halt.
In testimony today, former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who was involved in the decision to bail out AIG, went even further.
We have, after everything that was done, all the resources, we have 10% unemployment. I believe we easily would have had 25% unemployment.
But here's the problem. After the government pumped $85 billion into AIG, the insurer took the money and paid its customers in full for their debt insurance contracts. AIG's customers included big investment banks like Goldman Sachs. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch grilled Secretary Geithner today on why the government didn't force banks to take some loss on their AIG contracts.
We were changing the rules day by day, and we had the banks at a position where we could have exercised a lot of leverage, and you chose not to do
it. Right, I disagree with you.
And it doesn't mean we have to pay them 100 cents on the dollar or we let them fail. There are increments here.
Lawmakers also want to know why the government didn't say which banks got paid by AIG when it was bailed out. Here was Geithner's answer to that.
We would not want to disclose information that would be bad for the taxpayer, make it harder for the taxpayer to recoup our investments.
In other words, if the world found out that Goldman was at risk of collapse if it didn't get paid, Goldman could have collapsed, making matters worse across the economy. Bottom line, says Hugh Johnson, even the smartest guys in the room were scared and didn't want to play Russian roulette with financial institutions.
You know, you never really test these things. You ask the questions, but you never get the answers.
That was certainly the case on Capitol Hill today. But members of Congress don't seem likely to stop asking as long as populist rage against Wall Street continues to simmer. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Right about the time all that AIG stuff was happening, there was a slightly smaller shakeup in the global automobile industry. Toyota was becoming the biggest car maker in the world. They did it with an enviable reputation for safety and quality. That was then. In the year and a half since, Toyota has recalled more than 6 million cars for what seemed to be a fairly innocuous problem, floor mats interfering with the gas pedal. And then yesterday afternoon, the company said it is going to temporarily stop selling and also stop making 8 different models, including the most popular car that is sold here in this country, the Camry. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more.
Next week's production shutdown will affect nearly 60% of Toyota's products, including Corollas, Tundras, and Highlanders. Auto consultant John Cassessa calls the response extraordinary and expensive.
It will be in the billions when this is all over.
the lost production, the lost profits at dealers, and the cost sort of in advertising when production's restarted to get customers to come back.
Casessa says the transportation department asked Toyota to halt production and sales, which he says reflects more aggressive regulatory enforcement by the government. John Wakanowicz with IHS Global Insight says 8 people may have died as a result of the faulty accelerators.
They've known about this problem since at least 2008. They've been working to try to manage it since then, but at this point, the lid kind of blew off it and it simply got too serious.
Wakanowicz says the same accelerators are found in 8 different models because Toyota, like all car makers, is trying to standardize parts. Eric Desenhall, author of Damage Control, a book about corporate crisis management, says by stopping production, Toyota may hold on to its customers.
Good companies historically do bounce back after they do the right thing. And there's no question that this is a costly move in the short term, but can you imagine what the cost would be if they didn't conduct such a recall?
Desenhall says Toyota should be able to weather the factory shutdowns, assuming a fix can be found soon. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission put global warming firmly in the corporate context today. The commission voted 3-2 to force companies to disclose more information on the bottom line risks that they might face from climate change. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that investors have wanted more clarity on that for a long time now.
Before today's vote, SEC Chair Mary Shapiro made one thing clear. Quote, we are not opining on whether the world's climate is changing, at what pace it might be changing, or due to what causes, unquote. Still, Shapiro said companies must now disclose the significant risks they face from a warmer climate. Maryland State Treasurer Nancy Kopp hailed today's vote as a victory for institutional investors.
We can't be informed investors if we can't get access to all the material information about the companies in which we invest, and in a form in which we can compare company to company. And that's the great step that the SEC took today.
Now public companies must include any climate change risks in their quarterly SEC filings. That could mean estimating potential profits or losses from climate change legislation or disclosing other risks, like an insurer who may face more damage claims from rising sea levels. But Duke University law professor James Cox says don't expect much enforcement.
We've had a history, for example, on other environmental disclosures of a lack or a failure of compliance. The SEC has beat its chest in saying you ought to comply, but very little in the way of enforcement.
But companies are feeling the pressure. State insurance regulators, for one, are ordering the biggest insurance companies to reveal how they're estimating climate risk and what they're doing to fight global warming. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Late day enthusiasm on Wall Street will bring us the happy music today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all its sales and marketing savvy, for my money, Apple kind of blew it today with its new tablet computer. Not so much with the device itself, $499 stripped down, $829 top of the line. But did anybody else think the name was kind of a clunker? I mean, the iPad? Anyway, my issues aside, general reaction so far has been pretty positive, but analyst Josh Burnoff at Forrester Research says the iPad and a lot of the other new products and applications that are online now are changing the internet in some fundamental ways. Josh, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I confess I was a little distressed to read your post the other day about the Apple tablet and the Kindle and all this, basically meaning the golden age of the internet is over.
That's right. It's really the web that's shattering into pieces here. We've had 15 years now where there was a common standard for the kinds of computers that were connecting up to websites, and this really made it easy for the people who were delivering content to those folks. But now between iPhones and tablets and Kindles, you can't be sure if you build a website that everybody will experience it the same way anymore.
So who's this a bigger problem for? Is it a problem for consumers or is it a problem for people trying to create the content?
Well, for consumers, this certainly manifests itself when you turn on your iPhone and go to a website and it doesn't seem to work quite right. But I think it's more of a problem, really, for the people who are trying to reach those consumers because where they might have built one website and had it work on all different browsers and computers, now they have to make decisions. Are we going to make it run on an iPhone? Are we going to make it run on a Fios TV? And if so, you have to change the way you design it for the characteristics of those devices.
Well, give us an example of this thing you call the SplinterNet. I mean, how does it work in practicality?
Well, in practicality, let's just take Kraft.
Kraft, you mean as in Kraft Foods?
That's right. Kraft Food has an application called iFood Assistant that runs on your iPhone. Of course, if you happen to have a Google Android and you want to get that, well, you're going to have to wait and see if they bring it out in that environment. And this is replicated over and over again for every company that's trying to reach consumers. They now must decide which platform to head out on, something that just wasn't true 5 years ago.
It actually strikes me that it's a little bit like the early days in 93, 94, 95, when you had AOL and CompuServe and all the rest of them, and they didn't really talk to each other.
That's exactly right. When the web came along, it created this unified environment, and you know, you could send an email to anybody. Any website could be visible from anywhere, and that was all a result of the web standards that were created at that time. For 15 years since then, we've really been in a situation where because it was a unified environment, you had things like web analytics, you had things like Adobe Flash that ran everywhere and everyone could share.
Back up for a minute, web analytics. So the all-important measurement of who is going to which website and then how you can charge for advertising and monetization, I mean, the whole deal.
That's right. I mean, if you're an advertiser right now, you can have a banner ad. That same ad can run on a New York Times website or Yahoo. And when the traffic comes in from that, there's a standardized set of tools you can use to measure whether it was effective and where the customers came from and why they clicked on things. If you set yourself up with an Apple iPhone application, none of that infrastructure exists. People are trying to build it, but you're going to have to do that, and you'll have to do it separately if you do it on some other device.
And you, as a consumer, you need to choose your appliance carefully.
That's true. It's been true all along. I mean, ever since Beta versus VHS, we've been in an environment where if you made the wrong choice, you ended up behind. And it's true right now. You're going to be making a bet, and if you make the wrong bet, you might regret it later.
Josh Bernoff from Forrester Research and the Internet becoming the SplinterNet. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In his State of the Union speech tonight, President Obama is going to try to appeal to a whole bunch of different constituencies, interest groups both on the right and on the left of the political spectrum. Republicans and Democrats in Congress will no doubt be listening to the speech closely for things they will support or slam immediately afterward and in the days and weeks to come. Commentator Robert Reich says there is one more group that Mr. Obama is going to be addressing too.
President Obama's State of the Union address tonight will be shaped in part by the emergence of a new third political party in America. Call it the I'm Mad as Hell Party. It's a mistake to see the Mad as Hell Party as just a right-wing phenomenon, the so-called Tea Partiers, now storming the gates of the Republican Party. There are plenty of Mad as Hellers on the left as well, furious at Wall Street, health insurers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and establishment Democrats. Mad as Hellers on the right don't trust big government. Mad as Hellers on the left don't trust big business and finance. What unites them and gets both of them even madder is when big government gets too cozy with big business and Wall Street, and vice versa. Especially at a time like this, when Main Street is in shambles and millions of people are losing their jobs and homes. First it was TARP, the giant bank bailout that seems to have made Wall Street flush again. Then came the stimulus package, with earmarks dispensing goodies to big companies. And then health care, which looked to some people like a backroom deal between government, the pharmaceutical industry, and health insurers. To the Mad as Hell Party, the biggest event last week wasn't Scott Brown's upset victory in Massachusetts. It was the Supreme Court's decision, allowing corporations to spend whatever they want on political campaigns. True Mad as Hellers see this as opening even more collusion between private and public sectors. With the midterm elections months away, both Republicans and Democrats are scrambling to embrace the Mad as Hell Party as their own. Republicans were hoping the Mattis-Hellers forget the gushing corporate welfare of the Bush administration and the last Republican Congress. And many Democrats have become born-again economic populists, blaming the nation's problems on the same fat cat bankers and corporate lobbyists they've been taking money from for years. So listen tonight for how the president responds to the Mattis-Hell Party and how the Republicans respond to his response. This will be the real news.
Robert Reich is professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. You can send us your thoughts about the State of the Union or anything else you would care to comment on. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, organized labor tries to stay organized.
We end up having to have that conversation at the top level. That's where we'll end up to get this settled.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 41 points today, 0.4%, finished at 10,236. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.8%, closed at 2221. The S&P 500 added 5 points, nearly a half percent, ended things at 1,097. Airlines were jostled today by final 2009 passenger figures that showed a record decline in demand. U.S. Airways plunged 3.75%. Southwest fell nearly 2%. Delta basically flat today. Plane maker Boeing flew up more than 7%. That after it reported better-than-expected quarterly earnings. Canon says its business is clicking, with camera sales up fivefold over the past quarter, but the camera maker's stock still shot down 1.25% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.65%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for December. Those are products that typically last more than 3 years. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee discusses rescue, recovery, and reconstruction in Haiti. And MASH star Alan Alda turns 74. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Those are the bells of St. Johann's Church in Davos, Switzerland, about which there is this story to tell you. The church was built nearly 700 years ago, and over time, its spire was twisted by the stiff alpine winds, the story goes. It was repaired at great cost, only later to be bent out of shape once again. Not what you would call the most promising of omens for a conference whose official theme this year is improving the state of the world. David Rubenstein is what you might call a Davos regular. He runs the huge private equity firm, the Carlyle Group. He has been to the World Economic Forum 8 times. And when I spoke with him earlier today from Davos, I wanted to know from him what people were really talking about. In the panels and group discussion, sure, but also out in the hallways over a cup of coffee.
Well, I think three messages. One is the economy generally around the world is better than it was a year ago, so people are happier than they were. Two, there is some concern about overregulation and perhaps some political attacks on the business community. At least there's concerns by the business community about that. Mm. And third, I think there's a general view that the global scene is much better than it was before. There's more cooperation among governments than perhaps there was before on certain global issues. And there's a sense that there's more optimism here than there was, I would say, a year or two ago.
Is there an awareness that perhaps out in the global economy or at large that might not be the case?
Well, of course, there's no doubt the recognition of the fact that not everybody in Davos represents the whole world. People in Davos are a small sliver of the population of the world, for sure.
Well, along those lines, then, the panel you were on this morning is about the new normal after the Great Recession. And I'd love your thoughts on what that new normal in the global economy might look like.
I think the general view is that investors probably will get somewhat lower rates of return, that governments need to be more involved in trying to prevent the kinds of problems that we experienced over the last couple years, and that generally the business community hasn't been doing a very good job of explaining how it tries to create jobs, how it tries to respond to what government wants, and I think there's a sense that the business community can probably do a better job of that.
Mr. Rubenstein, what's your take on efforts here in the United States to tighten up regulations on the financial industry?
Well, I think every time you have a crisis of any type, financial crisis or energy crisis or any kind of problem, there's always an effort to tighten regulation, to improve the oversight of the industry that might be involved. Regulation is probably warranted in some areas to improve what the current situation is, but my hope is that there isn't an overreaction and we don't get overregulation that impairs the business community's ability to create jobs and to create profits.
Well, so what would overregulation be? I mean, should your firm, the Carlyle Group, a huge private equity firm, should it be regulated?
Well, we are regulated already by the SEC. We are a registered investment advisor, as many other large private equity firms are. We expect that there will be some type of registration of large private equity firms and smaller private equity firms as well as hedge funds. I suspect that will probably happen, and we accept that that is probably a given. But I think doing things that would impair the ability of private equity firms to do what they do, which is to invest money, hopefully create jobs, and make companies more efficient, impairing that ability, I think, would be a concern, yes.
Even though what you guys do, you and many other companies like you, has a huge effect on the overall economy, even outside the world of private equity.
Well, it does, though, in fairness, the private equity industry is a relatively small part of the global economy and a small part of even the U.S. economy. We do get attention when we buy companies that are well-known brand names. We make mistakes from time to time, as everybody does, and we try to correct those mistakes. But generally, we think we've been responsible. We just have to let people know what we're doing better than we have in the past.
What's left for you in Davos this year, Mr. Rubenstein?
Well, I think for me it's a matter of meeting people that I already know or meeting some new people that I think I would like to get to know.
I have to tell you, though, you seem like the kind of guy who could probably pick up the phone and meet anybody you want. Why do you have to go to Davos to do that?
You know, despite what people think about the new technologies we have, there's nothing that quite replaces face-to-face contact with people. And so, yes, maybe I can call a lot of people and maybe they will return my phone calls. But if you can meet just a small fraction of the people here, I think it's worthwhile and it's a useful endeavor for people in the business community and other parts of the global economy to come to.
David Rubenstein, Managing Director and Co-Founder of the Carlyle Group. Mr. Rubenstein, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
You can find out what is happening behind the scenes at the World Economic Forum by reading our blog. It's called The Daily Davos. It's at our website. It's marketplace.org. I don't know if you caught this last week, but the Labor Department had a really interesting statistic out this past Friday. A majority of all unionized workers in this country now work for the government. That is in part because government jobs haven't really been hit by the recession the way private sector jobs have. But also, it's because a lot of what used to be American union jobs are now being done overseas. So to try to keep their numbers up, organized labor is putting on a push to unionize jobs that can't go anywhere. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Neslyn McKellar Brown is standing in front of a Bank of America skyscraper in Midtown Manhattan. She's handing out Dayglow yellow flyers to anybody who will take them. She used to be a security guard at Merrill Lynch and a member of the SEIU, the Service Workers Union. But in November, she got laid off.
Now I have no health care. I have no job. I take medication for my high blood pressure, three pills a day. No, it's gone.
About a dozen others are here, too, handing out flyers and making noise. Some of them are wearing bright purple SEIU T-shirts over their winter coats. Mike Fishman's the president of SEIU Local 32BJ. He says the union isn't just supporting laid-off workers like McKellar Brown, or even just trying to organize the security guard industry. It's part of a bigger plan to unionize workers whose jobs can't be outsourced.
Security workers have to be here. They're not going to be someplace else. Building cleaners are going to be here. Apartment workers are going to be here.
The labor movement's had to deal with two big problems. it's lost members because traditional union jobs like manufacturing have been moving to other countries. Annetta Bernhardt is a policy director at the National Employment Law Project. She says unions have also had to deal with big changes in the way work is structured here in the U.S.
The biggest trend there is subcontracting, where a lot of service sector work that used to be performed in-house is now being contracted out to companies that can often provide those jobs at lower cost.
That's what happened to Neslyn McKilla Brown. She had been working for a multinational company hired by Merrill Lynch to provide security guards. McKilla Brown got laid off when B of A bought Merrill and switched contractors. The old contractor, her former employer, was unionized. The new one isn't. For the SEIU, it's protests like these that show people like McKilla Brown the union supports them. But where traditional unions would have only gone after the employers, the SEIU is going after the guys who pay those employers. In this case, the big banks. Mike Fishman says he's trying to convince Bank of America and its CEO, Brian Moynihan, to insist the new contractor, Wackenhut, pay union wages and give health care to its workers.
We end up having to have that conversation at the top level. That's where we'll end up to get this settled, I think. I mean, generally what happens is every person below Brian Moynihan will say to us, it's not our problem, it's Wackenhut's problem. Wackenhut will say to us, it's not our problem, it's Bank of America who doesn't want to pay for the health care.
The SEIU's been having those conversations all over the country, persuading employers to recognize unions and let service workers organize. And it's making progress. Membership has more than doubled in the last decade, and it now has more than 120,000 members. And it's ready to take on more of the big guys. Fishman says Morgan Stanley security guards are already unionized, and he's negotiating with Goldman Sachs. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, a cautionary tale about newspapers putting their content behind a pay-only firewall. That's what Newsday did back in October. Today, the New York Observer is reporting that the Long Island-based paper hasn't really seen the kind of interest it had hoped. Not even close, to be completely honest with you. Apparently, just 35 people signed up to pay a relatively modest $5 a week for online content. Here's the kicker. It cost Newsday $4 million to redesign the website and launch that pay service. And on that somewhat disheartening media note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 41 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 bumped up 4 points, nearly 0.5%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, Haitian relief goes to Davos. And coming up on this broadcast, young leaders at the World Economic Forum.
As a community, we have the business resource, we have the academic resource, we have the intellectual and NGO resource.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great evening. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.